all of my grading on the exams. I've done a bit of grading and I'm very pleased so far with the results. Those of you who took the exam should expect in just a few days to get something back with your scores. And I'll also, as I said before, circulate some information with general comments and suggestions about the exam itself. So look for that in just a few more days. Second, if you haven't done so already, we have some special learning forums for this week to discuss, among other fun things, the BP oil spill. I think there are some interesting and important organizational issues that have not been a major part of the public discourse on BP, and I think we'll have some fun. We're already having some fun talking about that on the forum, so be sure and look at that and be sure and participate if you haven't had a chance to do so already. Now, our topic for today is organizational design from the perspective of capitalism and entrepreneurship. Remember, we looked last time at implications of our entrepreneurial perspective for the boundaries of the firm. Should the firm expand or contract? How should it? What should be the scale and scope of the firm vertically, horizontally, and across the product space? So what we want to do today is apply our capitalist entrepreneur framework to thinking about some issues inside the firm. So for a firm of a given size, for a firm of a given scope, what is the best way to organize activities internally? How should the lines of authority be mapped out? How should employees be, what kind of incentives should be provided for employees? How do you give them, how should they be compensated? How should their behavior be evaluated and assessed? Those are some of the issues that we want to look at today. As has been the case every week, we don't have time to go into all of the interesting and important concepts, theories, studies, and so on. We're just going to do sort of a brief overview, a whirlwind tour through a very interesting literature on this subject, but hopefully give you some pointers and some reading suggestions that you can use to follow up later. As we've done every week, feel free to interrupt at any time with questions or comments in the chat window, or you can email them to me, and I'll speak for about the first half or first two-thirds of our 90-minute session, and then we'll the rest of the time just have some open Q&A. Okay? So without further ado, let me begin. Now, I want to start by recapping what we did at the start of last week's talk. Remember, we decided it was often useful to organize our thinking about the firm around these three questions posed by Ronald Coase in his famous 1937 article, right? The classic Coasean questions: why do firms exist, what determines the boundary of the firm, and how should the firm be organized? And already we've looked at the first two of these, and now we want to focus on the third. Remember that we're not only looking at the sort of transaction cost arguments that were favored by Mr. Coase, but we want to take specifically an entrepreneurial perspective. So really we want to look at the modern entrepreneurial theory of the firm. I hope that little piece of animation showed up, those of you who are viewing on the web, because I'm very proud of it. But anyway, so if we're looking at an entrepreneurial approach, we don't just want to look at Mr. Coase, but we want to focus on the great theorists, the great scholars of entrepreneurship, like, for example, I don't know, maybe this guy. Oh, no, wait, sorry, that's the wrong picture. I meant the great theorists of entrepreneurship, such as Joseph Schumpeter, Frank Knight, Israel Kirzner, and of course the founding Austrians, the great 20th century Austrians that we've been building upon so far, like Mises and Rothbard. Okay, now, some background issues and concepts. Some of the issues that we want to focus on include the allocation of decision rights or decision authority within the organization, how to provide incentives for members of the firm, and how to monitor and evaluate behavior. So I'll break our analysis down into three parts by looking at these three specific issues related to organizational design. There are also some key theoretical constructs or concepts that will pervade our discussion. For example, the distinction between general knowledge and what's often called specific knowledge. General and specific knowledge, that of course was the main distinction emphasized in the article by Jensen and Meckling that you looked at for this week, distinctions between general and specific knowledge. I think Jensen and Meckling cover that pretty exhaustively, so we don't need to spend a lot of time on it today. I want to speak a little bit about the concept of authority and what authority means in an organizational context, because I think it's sometimes misunderstood, particularly by Austrians and by libertarian scholars for whom the concept of authority seems suspicious or it seems to imply coercion. I'm going to suggest some more benign concepts of authority that don't imply any notion of coercion at all. And also the key element in neoclassical organizational economics, which is the notion of asymmetric information, and two specific manifestations of asymmetric information problems, namely the so-called principal-agent problem and the problem of adverse selection. I also want to remind you that in all of our discussion of organizational design, there are some elements of the background or the institutional environment, to use a term that we used a couple of weeks ago. Call it the business environment in this context. And for purposes of our discussion today, we're going to take the institutional environment or the business environment as mostly given or beyond the firm's control. So you'll see on the slide, on the right-hand side of the slide, a diagram. I don't know how well it will come across in your screen on DimDim there, but it'll come across better in the native PowerPoint slides. This is a diagram that I've just stolen from an MBA textbook that I've often used to teach this material, because I think it helps us to see how these different parts of the story fit together. If you can see the diagram clearly, what I'm calling organizational design, the authors of this particular textbook call organizational architecture. They use the term organizational architecture, but you can just consider that a synonym for organizational design. Right, so if you look in the middle part of the diagram, you see a box for organizational architecture, which includes three elements: decision right assignment, the reward system, and the performance evaluation system. The same three issues that we'll be discussing today. Now, you can see that organizational architecture works in conjunction with the firm's overall strategy. What industries to be in, whether to compete on price or quality and service or service, and if so, how to compete on price, a low price leader strategy, or to compete by offering premium products that sell for higher prices. Strategy and organizational architecture, or organizational design, work hand in hand to determine what the firm will actually do. So you can see incentives and actions below organizational architecture, and those ultimately determine firm value. So if the ultimate objective is to increase or to maximize, if you like, the value of the firm, managers, owners, entrepreneurs need to look at the incentives and actions that determine firm value and think about how organizational design or organizational architecture and strategy influence actions and ultimately firm value. Now you see at the top of the diagram a rectangle or a set of rectangles representing the business environment. So things like the state of technology, right? What kinds of IT products and services are available in the market? Are communications costs high or low? Is there a lot of computing power, a lot of storage ability, or not? What kind of production techniques are available in the market? Another part of the business environment includes market conditions, right? What are competitors doing? Are they strong or weak? Are they aggressive or not? Do they compete in the same markets or do they only compete in related markets? What about the behavior of customers and suppliers? If any of you have studied business strategy before, this just as an aside, the famous you might know the famous model from Michael Porter, the so-called Five Forces model, that looks at the influence of competitors and customers and suppliers on the firm's behavior. This really you can interpret this market box in terms of Porter's Five Forces. What are the sort of external conditions that constrain the firm's behavior? We might also think of government regulation or government policy more general, the tax code, the antitrust environment, regulatory climate, and so on, as being something that affects the firm as well. Now, the point that I'm making here is that these, from the point of view of the firm on kind of a day-to-day basis, it may be useful to treat these aspects of the business environment, the state of technology, market conditions, government policy, as exogenous. Right? So the firm operates within a particular business environment that constrains its behavior on a day-to-day basis. Now, that's really an oversimplification, right? Because we know that all three of those aspects of the business environment can ultimately be affected by or even changed by the behavior of firms, right? So the state of technology is not really exogenous, right? Because firms can do R&D, they can try to come up with new methods and new design schemes and so on to try to improve the state of technology, right? Likewise, firms don't take market conditions as given. They can try to influence the behavior of their customers, of their suppliers, of their rivals, and so on. Firms can try to influence the regulatory environment through lobbying, through campaign contributions, through bribery or whatever. Okay, so the claim is not that the business environment is ultimately, in a fundamental sense, beyond anybody's control. No, we're not saying that at all. We're simply saying for the purposes of strategy and organizational architecture, it may be reasonable to take the basic elements of the environment as fixed. So we're not going to look at those today. We're going to assume that the firm is operating within a given business environment and look specifically at how organizational architecture, or in our language, organizational design, can be used to improve or increase firm value. Okay, first fundamental concept, and one that you guys are familiar with from reading the Jensen and Meckling paper, is the notion of specific knowledge. Right? Now, I should mention as an aside, if you've read the article, you've noticed that they're quite heavily influenced by Hayek. They cite Hayek explicitly, and a lot of their discussion on different types of knowledge is based on Hayek's famous articles. Hayek's 1937 article, Economics and Knowledge, his 1945 article, The Use of Knowledge in Society, and some of his later works dealing with knowledge and behavior. This is very important for Jensen and Meckling, although their conceptualization of the problem is a little bit different from Hayek's. Right? They don't emphasize the concept of tacitness in the same way that Hayek does. So I think you'll recognize a Hayekian element here. Again, this is for those of you who have read a lot of Hayek. If you haven't, that's okay. But you can see that they're building on Hayek, but formulating the problem in a slightly different way. For example, Hayek distinguishes between tacit knowledge and explicit knowledge. Jensen and Meckling focus their discussion on a slightly different distinction, that between general and specific knowledge. Okay, and they conceptualize the distinction between general and specific in terms of the cost of transferring knowledge. So general knowledge is that which is easy or not very costly to transfer from one person to another, right? I don't currently know the scores of all the baseball games from last night, but I can easily look them up. Information that can be parameterized in numbers, in statistics, in data, for example, is pretty easy, it's pretty low cost to transfer electronically or otherwise. However, other kinds of knowledge or information are much more difficult or costly to transfer. scientific knowledge, for example. Suppose you wanted to learn the latest discoveries in astrophysics. Okay, well, any one of us could go to a library or go onto a website and retrieve the latest issue of the American Journal of Astrophysics or whatever they call it, and we could look at the pages and we could look at all the math and the diagrams and the equations, but it's unlikely that we would get much knowledge out of it, right? Unless you yourself have a PhD in astrophysics, you're probably not going to extract any useful information or knowledge out of reading a cutting-edge article in astrophysics, right? So scientific knowledge often can only be grasped by people who have a certain kind of scientific training, and that's not everybody, right? What you might call idiosyncratic knowledge, little bits of information that nobody bothers to write down. Okay, what Peter Klein had for breakfast this morning. I mean, I know it, but most people around the world don't know that, and it would be hard for them to find out because they wouldn't know how to get in touch with me. They don't even know, they don't even know that I exist. So it'd be hard for them even to try to track me down, right? What Hayek calls tacit knowledge is what Jensen and Meckling describe as assembled knowledge, but it's sort of the same thing, right? The idea that there is some knowledge that you possess in your head, but you cannot easily articulate in ways that you could communicate it to someone else. It could be because you've accumulated or assembled this knowledge over a long period of time, right? The example that I always use with my undergraduate students is, the knowledge of how to ride a bicycle. So, imagine that you know how to ride a bike, as most people do, and you're communicating with somebody by email, and someone across the globe, very far away from you, who's never ridden a bike before, and you're going to teach them how to ride a bike simply by emailing a set of instructions. Well, I mean, you could imagine instructions for how to ride a bike. Step one, stand next to the bike and hold it upright. Step two, while grasping the handlebars, stick one leg over the center of the bike and try to balance your weight on the bike. Step three, put your feet in the pedals. Step four, move the pedals forward, off you go. Right? So the person reading your email, they can read through those steps. But if they've never ridden a bike before, right, what's going to happen the first time they try it? They're just going to fall flat on their faces, right? Because there is a lot of knowledge associated with riding a bike, a lot of subtle things, how to shift your weight, how sharply to turn the handlebars, when to lean forward and back, how to work the brakes, how much pressure to apply on the brakes, right? These are things that if you know how to ride a bike, that knowledge is in you, it's in your head. But it's not in your head in a way that you could articulate it in words or numbers and easily pass that information on to somebody else. The only way to learn how to ride a bike is just to try it. It's just to go through it a bunch of times and fall down a bunch of times until finally you figure it out. You can think of more businessy examples, right? Imagine a salesperson who works a particular sales territory and has worked it for many, many years and then is going to retire. And pass along that knowledge to a newcomer, to a young apprentice. The experienced salesperson could give the apprentice, his little black book with names and contact numbers and notes that he's taken over the years about working with different customers, and the newcomer could read all that, but it's not going to be the same as having that experience, right? The experienced salesperson knows what techniques will appeal to particular buyers because he has a long relationship with those buyers. He just knows them. He knows their tastes and preferences intuitively, not in a way that he can easily pass on to somebody else, though. Okay? Right? The whole point of this, as Jensen and Meckling emphasize, and here they're building on Hayek's concept of, the knowledge problem, what Hayek calls the knowledge problem. If all of the knowledge necessary to operate a firm, or to allocate resources efficiently in an economy as a whole. If all of the knowledge were specific knowledge, then it would be easy in principle for one person to make all the decisions. Right? All of us in this firm or in this economy would just write down our knowledge or information. We'd email it to the central headquarters. The central headquarters would process all the information, make decisions, tell us what to do. You know, off we'd go. All right. Hayek's argument in his critique of socialism, right, is that that kind of a system doesn't work, because not only is important knowledge dispersed, meaning spread out among many individuals, even if those individuals wanted to communicate that information back to a dictator or to a central planner, they wouldn't be able to do so, because much of the knowledge is assembled or tacit. There's also idiosyncratic bits of knowledge that I don't even think to write down, much less to communicate to somebody else. Okay, that's Hayek. That was Hayek's argument in these famous articles for you know, what is sort of the essence of a capitalist market economy. According to Hayek, the essence of a market economy is the efficient utilization of tacit knowledge. Okay, the primary function of the price mechanism, of free markets and the price mechanism, according to Hayek, is to transmit information or knowledge throughout the system. Some of you may know, if you've ever read Hayek's 1945 article, he uses a famous example of tin, T-I-N, tin, that suppose, tin, is mined in Chile, let's say, and suppose there's some problem in the Chile, there's an explosion or an accident in a very large tin mine in Chile, right? Tin users around the world will be able to, they'll respond appropriately by economizing on their use of tin and substituting other materials instead of tin and constructing things. Not because they have any direct knowledge that there was a mine explosion in Chile, but simply because as a result of that mine explosion, right, the supply of ore that comes out of that mine will be reduced. The price of that raw ore will go up. So manufacturers of tin will have to raise their prices. And so tin users will see that the price of tin goes up. Okay? And people who manufacture things out of tin will begin to substitute other materials and cut back their consumption of tin. Exactly what a benevolent dictator of the world would have wanted in response to this explosion in the tin mine. But Hayek's point is, users of tin don't need to know anything directly about what happened in Chile. They don't need any specific knowledge about the situation in the tin industry. All they need to know is that the price of tin went up. And so they react as if they knew what was going on in Chile, even though they really don't. Right, the change in the price of tin is communicating to tin users implicitly the knowledge that something bad happened in the Chilean, tin mine, there was an explosion or whatever. Okay, that's Hayek's argument about the price mechanism, that prices embody information or knowledge, and that the price system is a giant communications network in which tacit knowledge is spread throughout the system. There's some argument about whether this, how this argument relates to Mises' argument on the impossibility of economic calculation under socialism. There are some obvious similarities, but some subtle and important differences as well. There's a huge literature on whether Mises and Hayek were saying the same thing or different things. For our purposes, we don't need to get into that for our purposes here. An important application to organizational design, right, if we take Hayek's argument or Jensen and Meckling's argument about specific knowledge and apply it not to the economy as a whole, but to a specific organization, you can see that there's an obvious parallel. Right, Jensen and Meckling refer to things like the co-location or joint location of specific knowledge and decision authority. Right, what do they mean? Well, in a market economy, right, which people in the economy have the necessary tacit knowledge or specific knowledge to know how much to produce or how much to consume or what technology to use or where to put an assembly plant and so on? It's not the central planners in Washington, D.C. or Brussels or Beijing or wherever, right? The central planners don't have the necessary knowledge to make those decisions appropriately. It's individuals, people on the ground, individual consumers, individual entrepreneurs, managers, and so on, who have the necessary specific knowledge about what to produce, how much to produce, where to produce it, what to consume, etc. Therefore, according to Hayek, the right to make the decisions about economic activity, about allocating resources, should be put in the hands of those who have that necessary specific knowledge. So individual entrepreneurs are allowed to decide where to set up their plants and what to produce and how much to produce. Individual consumers are allowed to decide what to consume, how much to consume, when to consume, etc. So you can imagine the same kind of thing going on within a firm, right? So it might make sense within an organization to delegate decision authority to those who have the necessary specific knowledge, right? Obvious example, think about this course. Think about the Mises Academy more generally and the course you're taking now. Specifically, think of the Mises Institute as a firm, right? And imagine that Doug French, or let's say Jeff Tucker, who's been coordinating the Mises Academy program, suppose that we could imagine a model in which Jeff Tucker designs all of the Mises Academy courses, and he says to me, he says, "Okay, Klein, we want you to teach a class on entrepreneurship and the capitalist economy. Here's how you're going to teach it. This is here's what readings you're going to assign. Here's what topics you're going to lecture on. Here are the PowerPoint slides. I've already prepared them for you. Here's what quizzes and exams you're going to give," and so on. Jeff Tucker could design the whole thing from the top down. And he could do the same thing with Bob Murphy's courses and with Doug French's courses and with Tom DiLorenzo's courses. Right, all of the courses in Mises Academy could be designed from the top down. And the only thing I would be hired to do is just to sit here and read a script, basically. But you can imagine that's not very effective, right? I mean, for the subject matter that I'm teaching, who has the necessary specific knowledge about, what readings are good for teaching this material? What subjects should be covered? How should the PowerPoint slides be designed? How should the quizzes and exams be written? Well, me. I mean, this is my area of expertise. I have a lot of experience teaching these topics. I have much more specific knowledge relevant to this course than Jeff Tucker does, okay? Or than Lou Rockwell does, or whoever is at the top of the hierarchy. Likewise, Tom DiLorenzo has the necessary specific knowledge to teach his course. To take advantage of the fact that the necessary specific knowledge is A, spread out or dispersed, and B, not easily articulated or communicated up the line to the dictator, it makes more sense for the Mises Institute to delegate that authority to the individual instructors. So Jeff Tucker says to me, "Look, here's the general area, in which we want you to teach a course. You go figure out how to do it. You pick the readings, you make the slides, you do, you give the lectures, etc." Okay? So, in a sense, the Mises Institute has located together the authority about how to design and administer the course with the specific knowledge about how to design and administer a course in this subject. I have the authority to do that because I'm the one with the specific knowledge. And so, it's a very sound principle of organizational design. Within a multi-person firm, it makes sense, as much as possible, to give decision authority to those who have the necessary specific knowledge. At the same time, it's important to take incentives and constraints into consideration, right? In the market economy as a whole, what gives the individual entrepreneur or the individual consumer, the individual manager, and so on, the incentive to use their specific knowledge in a way that makes sense? Well, it's private property and the profit motive. Okay, the entrepreneur wants to make the most possible profit, thus giving the entrepreneur a strong incentive to use his or her specific knowledge, in ways that are effective in satisfying consumer wants or whatever. Okay, how do you do that in a firm? Well, decision authority needs to go hand in hand with some appropriate incentives. Okay? So the Mises Institute needs to make sure that I'm not operating the course in a way that's inappropriate. Maybe there needs to be some monitoring and some governance. So suppose, just for the sake of the just for the sake of argument, not that this is true, of course, but suppose that I have a new book out, and the subject matter of that book is pretty close to the subject matter of our course, and suppose my main objective is to sell as many books as I can, right? Then every day I might just, every time I lecture, I might say, blah, 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 buy the book, blah, 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 read the book, blah, 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 buy a copy of the book for your mom, buy copies for your friends, buy as many copies of the book as possible, and that'll solve all the world's problems, right? In a case like that, delegating me all of the authority to decide how to do the course may not be in the Mises Institute's interest. Maybe the Mises Institute has objectives other than maximizing the sales of my book, right? In that case, giving me the authority to make these decisions about how to teach the course, you know, has a dark side too. So someone needs to be monitoring me and making sure that I'm not only saying buy the book, buy the book, buy the book. Wait a minute, that's why we have Grayson, I think. Okay, let's move on. I want to talk a little bit about the concept of authority, because many people think of authority as something scary or harmful. Libertarians especially often think of bosses as being, you know, mean people, like the mean teacher in my picture here. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a later part of the course when we talk about sort of government intervention and the firm. But for right now, I just want to remind you that authority is perfectly consistent with private property, private enterprise, and so on, as long as the person who is under authority, the subordinate, has willingly consented to be put in that position. Right? Then there's no sort of moral or ethical issue. If I willingly take a job at company X, and I sign an employment contract that gives my supervisor the authority to tell me to do this or that, well, I mean, I'm not being coerced, right? I agreed to it. If I don't like it, I can quit. Just as if the employer doesn't like me, I can be fired. But I want to refer you here to a famous article by Herbert Simon, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and psychologist, who wrote quite a bit on authority. In one of his famous articles, he distinguishes between two different types of authority, right? Problem is, many people think of authority and what Simon describes as type 1 authority, meaning authority exists when the boss tells the worker what to do. You, Mr. Worker, go here and do this. Klein, teach this course in this way. That's what we think of by, you know, bosses, supervisors sort of bossing workers around. Now, one of the reasons why that kind of authority strikes people as being inefficient or ineffective, right, is because it only works if the boss has at least as much specific knowledge as the worker, right? So, the boss has to know everything the worker knows and more. Otherwise, how does the boss know what to tell the worker to do in a way that, you know, creates value for the firm? It seems to ignore the Hayekian concept of the division of knowledge, that the worker knows some things that maybe the boss doesn't know. Then that's certainly true. But that isn't the only meaningful notion of authority. There's also what Simon describes as type 2 authority, where authority means not commanding workers to do specific things, but rather deciding what things employees can determine for themselves. In other words, deciding how much discretion to delegate to specific workers. So you can imagine that the boss designates some kind of desired outcome. Okay, I want my assembly line to produce a lot of automobiles at high quality, you know, with low defects and so on. Then I choose what decision rights to delegate to the line workers, how fast to run the line, maybe in what order to do certain steps, what kind of inspections to do. I set some constraints. I say that employees can't do this, or they can only operate the assembly line, you know, they can only control the speed within certain limits, and then I let things go. Then I let it run and see what happens. Okay? So, the fact that I hire you, ask you to do certain things on my behalf, but then allow you to determine exactly how you're going to do it, that's one form of authority. So, hiring, firing, And determining what people will be allowed to do on their own is a kind of authority as well. So authority doesn't mean top-down decision-making. Authority can also mean designing the hierarchy itself, coming up with the appropriate organizational design. And that does not in any way assume that the boss knows everything that the workers know. Okay? Obvious example would be the right to use an asset or the right to control how a machine is used. Right? So I might hire Grayson, let's say, to work on my assembly line, and he's at a particular stage in the assembly line where he operates a machine, a welding machine, let's say. And I say, Grayson, I want you to figure out the best way to use this welding machine. I'm going to delegate to you the authority to decide, how to hold it and how fast to run it and how it should be maintained, when it should be shut down, etc. Okay, so I'm going to delegate decision authority to you because I assume that you, as the expert welder, have specific knowledge about welding that I lack. I also want to give you some incentives. So I'm going to give you, what sort of looks like property rights. In other words, I'll say, if the welding station performs really well, you get a bonus. So you have some profit motive, as it were. You have an incentive to use your specific knowledge in a way that makes sense, in a way that generates economic value. However, that doesn't make you the ultimate boss. You're still subject to my authority because, number one, I can change those rules if I want to. Number two, I can fire you and replace you with somebody else. And number three, I can constrain your use of the asset in some ways. For example, you can't smash it to pieces with a sledgehammer if you want. And you can't sell the machine on eBay to somebody else. Okay? Unless you're the owner, you don't have the right to sell it. So I, as the owner, possess a kind of authority over you, even if I delegate to you most of the day-to-day decisions about how to use the welding machine. Okay? If you're paying attention, you might remember this sounds a lot like some of our previous discussions about entrepreneurs versus managers. Right? Capitalist entrepreneurs, owners of productive assets, can delegate responsibility for managing things to employees, but that doesn't mean that the capitalist entrepreneur owner doesn't possess the ultimate authority over those managers. Okay? Or to summarize some discussion that we've had before, right? Some decision rights can be specified in a written explicit agreement, but some of them can't. Right? Contracts are typically what we call incomplete, meaning they have some gaps. There's some things that are not specified in the contract. What do we do when those circumstances arise? Well, that's what ownership is. Right? Ownership conveys the right to make decisions about the uses of assets in situations not covered by the contract. Okay? So there might arise a situation in which it's not really clear whether Grayson is allowed to use the welding machine in that context or not. Well, I, as the ultimate decision maker, get to make that call. Okay? I mean, if I am the owner of the enterprise, Grayson, who's using my machine, cannot make that ultimate decision in situations that we haven't previously discussed. Okay? I mean, that Grayson and I haven't previously discussed. Okay. Let me mention, I don't want to dwell on these a lot, but sort of what you might call neoclassical economics of information, or neoclassical information economics. This is an area that's actually developed quite a lot in the past 20, 25 years. Several Nobel Prizes have been given in the area of information economics. The prize that was given in the mid-2000s, I forget the year, to Joseph Stiglitz, Michael Spence, and George Akerlof was given explicitly for the development of the modern economics of information. Now, this I call it neoclassical because this literature has a much more limited concept of knowledge than what Austrians would accept. So the neoclassical view here really thinks of information in a much narrower way. There's little distinction between general and specific knowledge, or what some people call information and knowledge, right? So what neoclassical economists mean by information is a number, okay? So a situation of perfect information is one in which, you know, I know that alpha is equal to 10, and Grayson knows that alpha is equal to 10, and all of you guys know that alpha is equal to 10, you know, in some mathematical model. Imperfect information is where, you know, a case where somebody doesn't know. I know that alpha is equal to 10, but poor Grayson, he doesn't know what alpha is equal to. Or he thinks alpha is equal to 5, it's really equal to 10. Okay, so one party knows something that another party doesn't know. That's what they mean by imperfect information. Or they sometimes use the term asymmetric information. Symmetric information, everybody knows the same thing. Asymmetric information, well, some people don't know things that other people know. Now, you might be thinking, duh. Like, you know, it takes a special subfield of neoclassical economics to deal with the fact that not everybody knows exactly what everybody else knows. And give me a break. You know, look, if you've had a lot of courses in sort of mainstream neoclassical economics, you know that most of it is built around the model of perfect competition, so-called perfect competition, in which all information is perfectly evenly and symmetrically distributed. So there is no asymmetric information or imperfect information in the perfectly competitive general equilibrium model on which much of neoclassical economics is based. So this was considered a breakthrough in the mainstream, you know, to recognize and deal with the fact that different people know different things. Again, a giant duh seems to come to mind, but there you go. A couple of specific applications of the imperfect information or asymmetric information literature. The so-called principal agent problem, or agency problems to be short, for short, and the so-called adverse selection problem. Both of these are cases in which there are two parties to a relationship or a transaction, a principal and an agent. And the idea is the agent has some information that the principal does not have. So in the classic principal agent problem, the principal might be the boss, the agent might be a worker, and the worker knows how whether he's hardworking or lazy, and the boss doesn't know. Right? The boss goes away in the morning and comes back in the afternoon and you know, sees that some work has been done but doesn't know how much effort the agent put forth. In a so-called adverse selection problem, the problem is not so much what the informed party does, but rather some attribute or characteristic that the informed party has. Just a quick couple of examples really quickly. Think of, you know, I see the picture here, a farm worker. Okay, so I can't tell what is being harvested in that picture. Maybe it's onions? Let's say it's onions for the sake of argument. You know, I'm a farm owner, I hire a farm worker to pick onions, I come back at the end of the day, I can observe how many onions were picked, but I don't know whether my agent was hardworking or lazy. Right, it might be that for whatever reason, conditions of the ground, conditions of the harvest, maybe it was very easy to pick a lot of onions, so even a lazy worker can produce a lot of them, right? What if I come back and there's very few onions, you know, brought back to the barn? I don't know for sure if that's because my worker was lazy or incompetent, or maybe, you know, the harvest is bad that year, the weather was bad, or it was very difficult to pick them that day for whatever reason. I don't know for sure whether my agent is a good agent or a bad agent. Now, I can make an educated guess, right? If the farm worker comes back with lots of onions, then I probably have a good worker, although I recognize there's a chance he may be a lazy worker who got lucky. If the worker comes back with very few onions, it's probably the case that he's a bad or incompetent worker, but it might be that he's a hard worker who just got unlucky, they just had a bad day. Right? I don't know that for sure. So there's this whole literature on how the principal can design an incentive contract try to deal with this problem, right? I can say, look, Mr. Agent, I'm simply going to pay you so many dollars per pound of onions, per bushel of onions. So I'll pay you according to how much output you produce. Now that gives the agent strong incentives to try to harvest a lot of onions, right? But there are some drawbacks too. I mean, the agent may shirk on quality if that's possible, may, you know, pick bad onions when I only want the good onions picked. So that's one drawback. Another problem is that agents may not find that very attractive. I mean, some hardworking, ambitious agents may think, oh, this is a great deal. I can, you know, I can pick a lot and I'll make a lot of money. But other agents may realize, they say, you know, they may say, look, how many onions come in at the end of the day really isn't up to me. I mean, a lot of that's beyond my control. I don't want to be penalized for things that are beyond my control. That's too risky. I would rather get paid so many dollars per hour. That way there's less risk. I'm not bearing as much risk. So, you know, fixed rate pay is kind of like a form of insurance for the worker. You could think of this in a sales context, right? Fixed pay versus working on a commission basis. Paying salespeople on a commission basis gives them strong incentives to try to sell a lot, but that also may not be very attractive to them because they have to bear a lot of risk. And risk-averse salespeople might prefer to work at least partly on fixed pay. They might want at least some base pay, maybe that you add a little commission to. The idea from the principal's point of view is that there's kind of a trade-off. No incentive scheme is perfect. Providing performance-based pay, tying pay to the outcome, provides stronger incentives, but if the agent doesn't have perfect control over the outcome, can be very unattractive for the agent. And it may be hard to find agents who are willing to work under those conditions. So the principal has to kind of manage this trade-off. We're kind of running out of time, so I'll skip the discussion of adverse selection for now. You can just do a Google search for adverse selection or famous example from George Akerlof, The Market for Lemons, and we can talk about it in the forums if you like. What I want to spend the rest of our lecture time on is primarily on decentralization and monitoring. Okay, so one way to think about or parameterize the delegation problem is to say, well, you know, should I operate my firm with kind of a tight hierarchy, where I make most of the decisions myself and I delegate only a few decisions to subordinates? Or should I have sort of a flatter hierarchy in which I do relatively little and I let my employees make as many decisions for themselves as possible? Well, you know, remember, our meme here is that no organizational structure is perfect in all times and places. No organizational structure is optimal under every set of conditions, right? Rather, what our theories help us to do is to think about the trade-offs between one form of organization and another. So, you know, rather than try to say all firms should be decentralized or all firms should be centralized or something in between, no, what we want to do instead is identify the benefits and costs of particular organizational strategies. And it's up to the individual entrepreneur owner to make decisions in context as to whether the benefits of one outweigh the costs and so forth. So let's frame it in terms of the benefits and costs of delegation or decentralization, right? Are there benefits to delegating authority to lower levels of the hierarchy? Well, sure. Makes more effective use of local knowledge in the Jensen and Meckling sense or the Hayekian sense. It conserves senior managers' time, right? It allows those at the top of the hierarchy to focus on other things, you know, long-run strategy and political strategy and so on, and allow people who are closer to the action to make day-to-day operational decisions. Provides training and motivation for employees, for lower-level managers, right? Gives them some experience and making decisions and having responsibility that can serve them as they get promoted up the line. Yet at the same time, decentralization has some costs, right? The principal agent problem, right? You delegate authority to subordinates, they might misuse it. They might abuse it. They might be pursuing their own goals, which could include goofing off on the job, right? You know, driving the company car on personal business, surfing the web during business hours, right? Those are costs to the organization, to the principal, but may provide benefits to the agent. There could be problems of, call them coordination problems. getting different parts of the organization to work well together. In my assembly line example, right, suppose I delegate to Grayson the authority for how to do the welding at his station in whatever way he sees fit. But if we have an assembly line, right, so imagine that components start out here at this station, then they go to Grayson's station, he works on them, then they get, then they go to the next station down the line. I want to make sure that what Grayson is doing, matches well with what the earlier stage is doing and what the later stage is doing. So if I allow each line worker, if I delegate to each line worker, too much discretion, it may be that the pieces don't fit together because they're all, kind of doing their own thing. Maybe some central coordination from a higher level manager or from the entrepreneur might be necessary in that case. There may be some central information that is difficult to put in everybody's hands. Let me give you a real world example with Mises Academy. Right? I have these wonderful TAs, Grayson and Dan, who, they know a lot about all the back end stuff. Right? Things that maybe I don't know. Okay, so my expertise is delivering the content, but I'm a nerd, I'm a pointy head, absent-minded professor type. I don't know how to operate DimDim correctly, and I don't know how to make sure that that the web meeting stuff is set up right, that students are enrolled properly. I don't know how to do all that stuff. Right? Now, if we didn't have Grayson and Dan, right, who know all that stuff and can do it for lots and lots of courses, then, we could run into real problems, right? So when we have some decisions that are made by a central authority, like, what server platform we're going to use for these courses and how to manage the server, well, then if there's a software upgrade or it's necessary to make some changes to the server or get a new server or whatever, I don't have to know any of that stuff. The central management of Mises Academy will take care of all that for me, right? If even decisions about the back end stuff were delegated to me, then I have to know what software to use and what version is on the server and when to upgrade and when to backup and all that. The Mises Institute would have to have some way of communicating that to every single instructor so that the instructor could manage that part of the course correctly. It probably makes more sense to centralize those decisions in the hands of just a few system administrators who can handle all that for everybody. Okay? So, too much delegation. One cost of delegation is that everybody with decision authority needs to know some central information. It may be hard to get that out. Okay? Jensen and Mecklen used this concept of, they emphasized the term alienability. Right, that it's important for certain decisions to be alienable or authority to be alienable. Right, alienable means that you can buy it or sell it. So a property right is alienable if I can give it to somebody else or sell it to somebody else. And owners have alienability rights, as we've already discussed, that employees do not have. Okay, so you can see the analogy that they draw out very explicitly between decision authority or decision rights within a firm and property rights in a market economy. Okay? We mentioned this just a few minutes ago. So in a market economy, individual decision makers who own property, right? Private property owners have the ability to make decisions and the incentive to make those decisions wisely. So Jensen and Meckling point out that decision rights in a firm are analogous to property rights in a market economy. Okay? But at the same time, as we've already discussed, there are some limits. Right? Within an organization, authority can only be delegated up to a certain point because the owner cannot delegate to non-owners, for example, the right to sell the assets. Okay? Because that you only have that right if you are, in fact, the owner. Okay? Now, I have some diagrams. I have my own sort of just a very simple benefit cost diagram. This is just a graphical illustration, right? I'm not proving any points with the diagram, but just for those of you who like diagrams, right? Imagine that we could measure the degree of decentralization or the degree of delegation on a scale, with call it D. You know, D equals 1 is not very much delegation, and D equals 10 is a lot more delegation, right? So imagine we can we put the degree of decentralization on the horizontal axis, and we put measure benefits and costs in monetary terms on the vertical axis. You know, you might have cost and benefit curves, right? So the diagram on the left shows that the costs of decentralization, and here I have them increasing at an increasing rate, and benefits increasing at a decreasing rate. In other words, if you drew, rather than total benefit and total cost curves, marginal benefit and marginal cost curves, you would have a downward sloping marginal benefit curve and an upward sloping marginal cost curve. And to find the optimal degree of decentralization, you could just look at where those curves cross, right? D star would be given in the marginal benefit, marginal cost diagram at the point where marginal benefits are exactly equal to marginal costs. In other words, given how decentralized I am now, should I decentralize even more? Well, if the marginal benefits of decentralization are greater than the marginal costs, then I'm to the left of D star, and I want to increase my decentralization a little bit. I want to move to the right, okay? If, given where I am now, the marginal benefits, the benefits of decentralizing even further, are less than the costs of decentralizing even further, then I've gone too far, right? Then I'm to the right of D star. So I want to find the optimal degree of decentralization by balancing these marginal costs and marginal benefits, right? But now imagine that something in the environment changes. You know, say there is some, you know, technological innovation that, you know, say some new software that allows me to monitor my employees more easily, right? Well, remember, one of the costs of decentralizing is that my employees might, you know, abuse their authority by, you know, doing things, you know, that are in their own interest. So my workers might be, you know, I give them computers and I give them freedom to use the internet to do their jobs, but instead they're just on Facebook or, you know, they're playing World of Warcraft or something like that. Imagine that now I get some, you know, somebody invents new software. Well, we already have it, but, you know, software that allows me to monitor easily what's on everybody's desktop. I can see all my employees' desktop, you know, computer desktops very easily with a few mouse clicks. That makes it easier for me to tell if they're goofing off or not. If you like, that would lower the cost of decentralization. If some technological innovation makes it easier to monitor my employees, well, one of the costs of decentralization has just gone down. What does that imply for how much I should decentralize? Well, those of you who like to draw diagrams and shift curves know what's coming, right? We could shift the cost curves down. So whether we prefer to draw a total cost curve or a marginal cost curve, if the costs of decentralization fall because of some technological improvement, notice what happens to the optimal degree of decentralization. It's not D star anymore. Now it's some higher level of decentralization, D with 2 stars, okay? All this diagram is saying, intuitively, right, is that if one of the costs of decentralization falls, we would expect firms to respond by decentralizing more, okay? Suppose the other way around, if the cost of decentralizing went up, we'd expect firms to decentralize less. Or conversely, if the benefits increase, they'll decentralize more. If the benefits decrease, they'll decentralize less. So you can think of things in the business environment in that pink diagram near the beginning as being things that could shift these curves around. So the point is, if we want to understand changes through time in the average degree of decentralization, or maybe changes across markets or across countries, this kind of framework can be very useful, right? If we find, for example, that firms have become more decentralized over time, as many people think is the case over the last two or three decades, right? It probably isn't the case that, you know, firms always should have been very flat. They always should have been highly decentralized. They just were too dumb to know it. And all of a sudden they woke up one morning and figured it out. Or some smart consultant you know, or Charles Koch or somebody told them, hey, decentralizing is a good thing. And they said, hey, wow, we never thought of that. Let's decentralize. Everything's great. That's probably not the best explanation. It's more likely the case that something in the environment changed such that, you know, 3-4 decades ago, a more centralized structure made sense. But because of changes in technology, changes in market competition, for some industries, changes in the regulatory environment, made it such that the old optimum was no longer optimal, and now it made sense to decentralize more. Okay? So I think this kind of framework can help us, you know where to look. We want to look for things in the environment that affect the benefits and costs of decentralizing. Okay? If we want to explain why firms have changed their degree of decentralization over time. Now, my diagrams are pretty simple, right? The Jensen and Meckling diagram is basically the same thing, but uglier, okay? Excuse me. They also have decentralization on the horizontal axis, going from left to right, but they measure it in this sort of weird way, distance of decision rights from the CEO's office. So to the right on their scale, like on mine, means more decentralized, okay? So you can see completely centralized on the left at the top, completely decentralized on the right. They also have benefit and cost curves that are sort of similar to my marginal benefit and marginal cost curves. I drew mine as straight lines. They have theirs as curves. But then they sort of sum them to come up with this U-shaped thing. Basically, what they're saying is, you know, you want to be at the minimum of that U-shape. You know, if diagrams are not your thing, don't worry about this diagram at all. The intuition from their article, from their diagram, is exactly the same as what I just presented with my simpler diagrams that I use in my classes, right? That firms want to figure out where to be in this, you know, decision right space by comparing the organizational benefits and costs of different levels of delegation, okay? So their version is just a more complicated version of mine. Same exact, supposed to generate exactly the same insight, okay? Okay, just briefly, a few words about incentives and monitoring. Based on principal-agent theory, right, we can say some things about how firms should pay people. You know, should salespeople get paid on commission, or should they get paid a fixed salary? Well, again, there's no optimal answer for everybody. What our analysis does, what our theories do, is simply say that, well, you know, performance pay has benefits and costs. Fixed rate pay has benefits and costs. You need to weigh those and, you know, sort of see how things come out on the margin, given the specific circumstances that you're in. For example, you know, strong performance-based pay, giving workers performance-based bonuses, paying workers in equities and stock options, or in stock or stock options rather than cash, paying people on a commission basis rather than base pay. Under what circumstances do those kinds of things tend to work best? Well, things like what you see on the slide there. If output, the performance result as far as the principal is concerned, if it's very sensitive to the agent's effort, then the benefits of providing strong incentive pay are probably, you know, probably exceed the cost, right? I mean, it may be that profit or performance, it really doesn't matter whether the agent works hard or is lazy. You know, products that quote-unquote sell themselves. If you don't need the agent to do a lot, then why, you know, why give them performance bonuses? It's not going to make much of a difference to your bottom line, and it's going to make their pay riskier, which they don't like, so probably don't want to do it. On the other hand, if output, meaning, you know, either quantity or profit or value or whatever, is highly sensitive to how hard your agent works, then you probably do want to go ahead and use performance pay, even though it's risky for the agent. If you have agents who don't care much about risk, and you guys all know people like this, right? People who are sort of go-getters and very confident, and they are very, you know, they strongly believe that they will get the bonus every time. Okay, then go ahead, give them, pay them on commission. They'll like that. There's other characteristics of the agent. Is this a person who responds very well to more money, or someone who doesn't. You know, the optimal incentive scheme for you and me might be different from the optimal incentive scheme for, you know, Mother Teresa or someone like that, whose behavior really isn't affected much by compensation. In that case, I wouldn't use a performance-based pay scheme, right? It might make the person uncomfortable, and it's not really changing their behavior very much because they don't care how much they get paid, okay? Those are the kinds of things that you would want to look at. I have a little bit of some comments about different kinds of performance evaluation, but I think I'll save that for the forums just in the interest of time, because I want to cover one last point and then stop. Some of the discussion in the book and some of the work that Nikolai Foss and I have done on original and derived judgment, I think, fits in here to add a more explicit Knightian, Misesian, entrepreneurial spin to the discussion that we're having. Remember that in our work, we distinguish between what we call original judgment, the judgment held by the capitalist entrepreneur himself, and what we call derived judgment. In other words, in a world of Knightian uncertainty, I may say to Grayson, my assembly line worker, look, there are a lot of uncertainties about market conditions, about changes in technology, about how people work together, things that I cannot anticipate with certainty. I'm going to delegate authority to you as my subordinate, as my agent, and I'm going to ask you to use your own judgment, right? I want you to act like an entrepreneur, you know, in figuring out how to work the welding machine or whatever. Now, remember, Grayson is not, he's not really an entrepreneur in the sense that he's not an owner. He's just an employee who works for me. But I say, look, you know, act as if you were the owner of this asset. I want you to use your judgment, use entrepreneurial judgment on my behalf. Foss and I call that derived judgment. It's sort of like judgment, but not exactly. Right? Now, it takes advantage of Grayson's specific knowledge. It could be multi-layered. Grayson could go on to hire Dan as his subordinate. And then, you know, my original judgment is delegated to Grayson, who then delegates some of his derived judgment to Dan, who then has derived judgment, and so on. Right, so you could think about the corporation as sort of a nested hierarchy of judgment in this sense. On the other hand, I may be worried that Grayson is using this judgment that has been delegated to him, you know, in a way that's bad for me. He abuses it, and then Dan abuses it, and so on. And knowing Grayson and Dan, I mean, come on, it's pretty much what you'd expect, right? That also calls to mind a distinction between what we might call productive and destructive entrepreneurship, right? So productive entrepreneurship is where Grayson, acting as my delegate, exercising his derived judgment, uses it in a way that benefits me. But he might use that derived judgment in a way that benefits him at my expense. I call that destructive entrepreneurship, value-destroying entrepreneurship. You know, finding ways to shirk on the job, finding ways to engage in holdup in the Williamson sense, rent-seeking, and so on. The key task of organizational design from an entrepreneurial perspective is to manage this delegated judgment in the right way, right? So how do I set up the firm so that Grayson will use his derived judgment in ways that benefit the organization as a whole, while I constrain his use of derived judgment to benefit him? So thinking about how judgment can be monitored, how it can be evaluated and constrained by the entrepreneur, that's the key aspect of entrepreneurial design, of organizational design from an entrepreneur's point of view. Okay? That's all I had for my slides. I talked a little bit more than I wanted to, but Let's talk about some things that didn't come up in our discussion. I'm looking at some of the stuff that you've been doing before. Let's see. Da, 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 da. Okay. So the first question was about about how the term businessman is used. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't read Peter Schiff's new book. You know, a lot of times people use the term businessman. Well, let's put it this way. Some people use the term entrepreneur as a shorthand for, you know, anybody who works in business. So businessman is probably the more generic category. Some people might use it without distinguishing between entrepreneurs, properly speaking, managers, and others. So, I mean, we'd have, just have to look at that on a case-by-case, case-by-case basis. Well, I'm even worse than Grayson. I mean, Grayson used to work for the state of California. I, for a brief period of my life that I'm not very proud of, actually worked for the U.S. federal government. But let's not talk about that. Okay. Other questions or comments about organizational design, about organizational structure? Grayson, I was trying to, I was trying to tear things down from the inside. That was my plan, that I would ascend to the highest levels in the federal government, then I would just shut it all down and we would have sort of a libertarian utopia, but unfortunately I didn't last that long. Okay. Let's save, we'll start up another discussion forum. We'll start a forum for, you know, true confessions. You know, somebody can say I cheated on my spouse, or, you know, I shoplifted, and then other people can say I worked for the government, and, you know, we can all get out our deep, dark secrets, the things that we're really ashamed of, but let's not do them now. Other issues associated with today's discussion. Anybody? Yeah, let's use pseudonyms too. Yeah, Grayson, if we can set up an anonymous forum where we can confess bad things that we've done, like working for the government, I think that would be a good thing. Okay, so we got the slides. Libertarian confessions. That's a little bit too scary, I think. I'm not sure that I can handle that. Let me check my email, see if anybody has emailed me a question during the lecture. I don't see anything specific to the class. Let me check my other account. You guys are just all in the, you're in the zone tonight. You're just in the groove. Everything's sinking in. Ah, here's a question. Abilash. Stock markets are obviously different from other markets. The prices of shares in a stock market reflect the opinion of players in a stock market about economic soundness. Da-da-da-da. People are freely buying and selling. Ah, okay, this is a good question. I didn't check to see what thread you were posting this on. This is a forum question. I'm actually, let me hold off on that, Avalosh, until I think that's best discussed in the context of that forum. Sorry, let me go back to Dean has some questions here. Specific knowledge of time and place can still be of a consistent character. Importance of specific knowledge can be absorbed more quickly, given the correct previously learned frame of reference. I'm not sure exactly what you mean, except that one's ability to make use of his own specific knowledge and to try to glean useful bits of information based on other people's specific knowledge certainly is something that can be and is learned from experience, no doubt about it. Dean asked then an interesting question about sort of corporate succession. Right, so how does one go from a lower level of the organization to a higher level? Do you work your way up through the ranks in an existing firm? Or is it more likely that top management positions are filled from the outside? Dean, I mean, I'd have to look at the data. Anecdotally, you hear a lot of complaints about outsider CEOs. Right, that in the old days, to be the head of a car company, you had to start out as an auto mechanic or a car salesman and work your way up. Now you don't have to know anything about cars. First point is, I'd have to look at the data. My sense is, it's probably not as big a change as we think. Anecdotally, there are some high-profile cases. But I don't know that that's really as that may not be as new a phenomenon as as we think it is. Certainly, as companies have become larger and more diversified through time, right? I mean, it's not even clear what it would mean to come up through the ranks of a company like GE, right? I mean, you could come up through the ranks of one division, and you might know everything there is to know about light bulbs, but that doesn't give you any specific knowledge about making jet engines or microwave ovens or consumer finance and so on. So the more diversified a company is, the less likely it is that the top-level managers will have a lot of specific knowledge about, sort of at the industry level, simply because the firm is in, is in so many different industries. Now, what people will often say is that, yes, but you can have, specific knowledge about how to read divisional income statements and balance sheets. Okay, during the 1960s, there was a style of management that was sometimes called management by the numbers. And certain executives, like a famous, best example is a guy named Harold Janine, who was the CEO of ITT, International Telephone and Telegraph, which was one of the big conglomerates of the 1960s. And it was in hundreds and hundreds of different business industries, product lines. And Janine said, I don't know anything about most of the products we produced. I don't have to. I simply know how to manage an efficient internal capital market. Right? I'm like a good mutual fund manager. And that's all you need to be, the CEO of a large corporation or the CFO. You don't need product-specific expertise. You just have to know, you have to be good with numbers. You have to know how to read financial statements. If that's true, then working your way up could simply mean, having accounting expertise, having financial expertise, might have nothing to do with products, right? Now, the Janine model is a little bit out of fashion today. In the last few decades, there's been kind of a reaction against that, and the sense that firms should be a little bit more focused, they should emphasize their so-called, core competencies, and that it is important to have some industry-specific expertise, even at higher levels of the organization. Dean, you're exactly right that, if you know everything about light bulbs, it's likely that you know lots of things about other kinds of light bulbs or maybe other consumer electronics, and that specific knowledge may translate more easily across products. But again, it depends how the large firm is managed. If the firm is managed in a more centralized fashion, then it would be important for executives in the corporate office to have a lot of industry-specific expertise. On the other hand, if the firm is managed in a highly decentralized fashion, that may not be necessary, right? So again, think about the Mises Academy as an example. Jeff Tucker, who does a fantastic job managing the portfolio of courses offered by Mises Academy, is not himself a college professor. Now, Jeff, knows as much about Austrian economics as anyone from working at the Mises Institute for many, many years, but, Jeff is not a PhD economist, economics professor type guy. Does that matter? I don't think so. I think to be a good administrator of the Mises Academy, he has to have enough knowledge about economics and about teaching to make it all work, but he doesn't have to be an expert in those things. He needs to know more about, he has to know more general management skill and know how to evaluate whether, what's working and what's not working in terms of course design and which courses are more or less profitable and where should we expand or, cut back, that sort of thing. So what kind of expertise is valuable in a given organization depends on organizational size, depends on how diversified the firm is, depends on whether management is centralized or decentralized, okay? Robert, any thoughts on the book, The E-Myth Revisited? No, I'm not familiar with that book. It would be great if you could post something in the forums about it. Maybe you want to say a sentence or two now about what the book's about, but no, I don't know it. If what you're getting at is, if I had to guess based on the title, there is some There are some, there has been some literature claiming that sort of the e-commerce revolution has been exaggerated, right? So in the mid to late 90s, people were saying, oh, because of the internet, oh, you're talking about the entrepreneurship. Okay. Regardless of what Robert's talking about, let me talk about something else. It was said in the 90s that because of the internet and the e-commerce revolution, all firms can be radically decentralized, and we really don't need corporate hierarchies at all. We can outsource everything because the internet has made transaction costs so low. Every firm can be run by one or two people with a website, and they can outsource all the production to Taiwan or mainland China, and they can outsource all the delivery to UPS or FedEx, and that's all you need to have a firm. I think that has been exaggerated. Right, the impact of, of the IT revolution of the 90s, I think, has been somewhat exaggerated in terms of its effect on organizational form. That does, on the margin, in many cases, increase the benefits of decentralization, but not to the degree of, making all firms radically decentralized. Okay, I guess I should try to read the book that Robert's talking about before. Before blabbing on about other things. Robert, there's also another book by Scott Shane, who's a very prominent mainstream entrepreneurship theorist, and it's called something like 10 Myths of Entrepreneurship, or maybe it's more than 10, Many Myths About Entrepreneurship. Maybe somebody knows that book. I haven't read it, though I've read some excerpts, and it looks pretty good. It's mostly based on the data. Right, so a lot of the factoids that you hear about the benefits and challenges of entrepreneurship turn out not to be correct. So check it out. Anyway. Oh, Dean knows the Gerber book too. Most entrepreneurs started out as really talented technical workers who got annoyed with management. I don't know if I would say most entrepreneurs took that path, but certainly many did. There's some very good literature on this, particularly in the technology sector, some good academic studies of what they call entrepreneurial spawning. And the idea is that there are two different kinds of spawning. There's sort of good spawning or positive spawning and bad or negative spawning. What Gerber's describing is what this literature calls negative spawning, right? So very smart people, particularly, programmers, IT folks, whatever. They don't like the bureaucracy, and they feel like the sales department or the central management is shooting down their ideas, so they quit, right? But there's another model too. The sort of negative spawning, what Gerber's talking about, we often think of companies like IBM, sort of large so-called bureaucratic firms, that in which a lot of entrepreneurs that spawn a lot of entrepreneurs who are frustrated and fed up with the company's culture. But there's another model too. What you might call the Fairchild Semiconductor model, right? Fairchild Semiconductor is the legendary California firm that spawned HP and lots and lots of the big Silicon Valley, the important Silicon Valley firms. That was a case where people said the environment at Fairchild was so good, it was so nurturing, it was so conducive to entrepreneurial, the entrepreneurial spirit, that a lot of the people who quit Fairchild and founded their own companies did it because they had received great training. Fairchild taught them how to be entrepreneurs, and they applied that knowledge to start their own companies. There's also the kind of spawning, what they call necessity entrepreneurship, right? The old joke where, guy says to his friend, "Hey, what made you decide to be an entrepreneur?" He says, "Well, something my boss said to me one day." "What's that?" "You're fired." Okay, so a lot of people become entrepreneurs involuntarily because maybe they don't have good employment opportunities as employees, and entrepreneurship is the next best thing. So it's not always, done sort of out of desire. I won't say any more about Gerber before I read it, but business owners should codify and write down their business processes as much as possible. To make business resilient to personnel changes. That's a good, I mean, that's a reasonable point. At the same time, if we believe that a lot of, sort of the really effective, routines in firms, practices in firms, are the ones that are not, that are hard to codify because they're tacit, right? Tacit routines and capabilities that would be hard to write down if even if we wanted to, the things that we describe as corporate culture, right? If those are important, then it may be that the only way to sort of to be able to understand and make use of those practices is by absorbing them, through experience, right? So I mentioned last time this well-known management writer, Edith Penrose, and her theory on firm growth. I mean, what Penrose argued was that routines and capabilities within firms often cannot be stated in a way that you could pass the knowledge on to someone else, or that you could sell your capabilities to another firm. Right, the only way that capabilities are developed and passed on is through accumulated experience, and that as firms grow, right, they begin to develop excess capacity in their routines and capabilities, and so that's why they end up expanding into other areas. The only way to make use of the knowledge that they've accumulated is by actually doing more things. In other words, if they could codify their routines into a formula, they could write a book and they could sell the book, right? Or they could hire themselves out as consultants to some other firm. But according to Penrose, that's very difficult to do because a lot of these things cannot be codified, right? I mean, that's what consultants do, and that's what guru books are all about. People like Jim Collins or whatever, there's this whole huge industry of selling, of writing things down as the 10 P's of successful marketing or whatever it might be, the 7 habits of highly successful people and so on. That's one of these, you think, well, if that's really so good, why are you telling other people about it? Why don't you keep it 100% to yourself? Why are you selling it so cheaply to so many other people? Why are you giving it away in lectures and so on? So maybe a lot of the kinds of capabilities, organizational routines that really matter are the ones that are simply too hard to articulate, okay? Anything else? Other issues about delegation or authority, principal-agent problems, the market for lemons, anything else that's on your mind? It's just past 6:30, but we can hang out for a few more minutes if anybody has something biting. Oh, I missed a question from Abhilash. I'm sorry, I did miss it. Okay, Jensen and Meckling say that general knowledge is not easy to transfer. Sorry, the general knowledge is easy to transfer and specific knowledge is not. But is that really the case? People have varying tendencies to learn skills in various subjects. So is this not all subjective? It may be easier to transfer knowledge on advanced calculus to a specialist in mathematics, but he may be dead as opposed when it comes to even to basic cooking, like boiling water. Abhilash, I think what you're getting at is that whether a given piece of knowledge is classified as general or specific may depend on the characteristics of the individual, characteristics of the recipient, right? So some kinds of knowledge are easy to write down, but not everybody can read the recipe in a way that makes sense. Right? Other things may be only implicit for some people, but can easily be received by other people. I think you're exactly right. Right? So if we want a more general explanation for the benefits and costs of transferring different kinds of knowledge, right, we do need to take individual characteristics into account. Right? So, trying to think can I use soccer as a good example? I'm not a soccer fan. I don't play soccer. I don't follow soccer. I didn't follow the World Cup very closely, but I do follow other sports much more closely. So clearly, a soccer fan and I could have watched the World Cup final together and gotten very different things out of it, right? But even on the metrics, the things that you can write down and transfer, if you don't even know enough about the sport to know what metrics to look for, there's no way you're going to possess that knowledge, even if it is codified, right? So, yes, the characteristics of the individual matter a lot. By the way, soccer is interesting. Sports are interesting in this context more generally. As those of you from outside, well, a lot of you know, regardless of where you live, there's this sort of big mystery of why soccer is less popular in the U.S. than it is almost everywhere else in the world. So I'm kind of like the stereotypical dumb, arrogant American in this sense. That I say, yeah, American football, basketball, baseball, those are the great sports. And soccer, that's what the rest of the world plays. That's a commie sport. I'm not interested in it. It's terrible. One of the interesting things about soccer is that there is a lot more tacit knowledge or specific knowledge involved in how one appreciates the game. Right? One attempt to explain why Americans prefer, let's say, baseball to soccer or American football to soccer is because they like measurement. Americans like measurement. Right? So look at baseball, for example. There's lots and lots of data. There's batting averages and, you know, fielding percentages, and they're very, very obvious objective measurements of performance. Lots and lots of numbers that can characterize a baseball game. So somebody who's a baseball expert can look at they can look at the box score from a baseball game and really understand a lot about how the game was played. Soccer doesn't have as many metrics. Right? I mean, you don't have as much variation in score. Just knowing that a game ended 1-0, you know, how close was it? Was it really competitive? Was it one-sided? It's really hard to tell. You know, in basketball, you know, you can tell a lot by the score. You know, 75 to 74, that was a close game. 100 to 50 was a blowout. You can have blowouts in soccer, so to speak, that aren't reflected in the score. So soccer is, you have to be more sophisticated, or you have to have, there's a lot more tacit knowledge involved in appreciation of soccer than in other sports when you have more measurement. I remember reading something about some famous soccer match, you know, that it ended 1-0, and the analysts were saying, you know, this game wasn't even close. And I'm thinking, yeah, but the score was 1-0. That sounds pretty close to me. In other sports, if it's not even close, it should have ended like 12-0. I mean, how can it be 1-0 and not be close? Okay, anyway, sorry, I'm ranting just a little bit. Bella and Nikita and others will lecture me and train me properly in soccer appreciation. Now, I'm sure the octopus had something to do with it. I think the octopus must be a good example of Knightian judgment. Clearly, the octopus did not follow a mathematical decision rule, at least not one that any of us know about. Okay, last but not least, let's take one more question and then let's knock off for the day. Any other questions about soccer or sports or confessions or anything else? Okay. Either nobody has a question or somebody's typing a very long question that I'm going to ignore, but I won't ignore you on the forums. So let's continue this discussion on the forums. If you haven't participated in your analysis of BP and other things, please proceed to do so, and I'll get the exams finished up, get them back to you as soon as I can. Likewise, Robert, nice to meet you. I don't know if any of the rest of you were in Las Vegas this weekend for the Freedom Fest, but the Mises Institute had a little mini seminar there, which was quite good and quite fun. Maybe some of that will be available on video. I'm not sure. So anyway, good night, everybody.